Well, this is a festival of ideas, whatever that is. So I thought I would talk about ideas and where they come from. It's a funny thing, actually, because there is one question that all writers hate being asked, and it's a question that always gets... It's usually one of the first questions. Any writer doing an event, one of the first questions will be the question that we all hate, which is, where do you get your ideas from? Because there's no easy answer to it. It's not as if there is a little website that you can log on to, like Ideas Are Us, and you put in everything you want and it will send you back some nice ideas to use. Ideas are all around us, and it's very hard to think back to when you started a book, like, how did that happen? How did everything come together from all those different places that you ended up writing that particular book that you wrote? But that's what I'm going to try and talk about today. It's quite a long story, so I hope you're sitting comfortably. It actually starts in 1815. I told you it was a long story. Where there was a volcanic island off the coast of Indonesia called Mount Tambora. And in 1815, Mount Tambora erupted. And if Mount Tambora had not erupted in 1815, I would not be standing here today talking to you about my new horror series. Darren Shan wouldn't have written any of his Vampire Assistant novels. The Walking Dead wouldn't have been on, the second series wouldn't have started on TV last night. All these vampire and zombie stories that are so much around us in films, in books, in TV. We wouldn't have Twilight. Some of you may or may not think that is a good idea. True Blood. Any of the zombie films, vampire films, zombie games. Zombie games, for instance. Zombies and vampires are everywhere. Stick your hands up, any of you, if you've played any of the zombie computer games like Left 4 Dead or Call of Duty in zombie mode or Plants vs. Zombies. It's a good game. Pretty well nearly all of you kids have played these zombie games. Well, you wouldn't have played any of those games. And you wouldn't have seen any of those films, comics, books. They wouldn't probably have existed if Mount Tambora had not erupted in 1815. Why is that? Well, that's what I'm going to try and tell you about today. As I say, Mount Tambora was this volcanic island, which means it was a huge mountain sitting on the floor of the ocean, top of it sticking out above the water, and there were lots of Indonesian people living on it. But not for much longer, because after it erupted, one minute there was an island there, the next minute there was nothing. Thousands of people wiped out. But worse than that was that everything that had been Mount Tambora was suddenly blasted up into the sky. So billions of tons of rock and dust and soot and volcanic ash and all this stuff was shot up in this vast black column up and up through the sky, through the atmosphere, up through the stratosphere, up to the very top level of the atmosphere where you have the jet stream, which are these massive winds that travel all the way across the face of the planet. And slowly this black cloud was spread until the following year, 1816, it covered nearly all of the northern half of our planet, which meant that the light and the heat of the sun was blocked by this cloud. And it meant that that year, 1816, was known in northern Europe as the year without a summer, as this huge cloud sat there. And it wasn't just that it was not very nice. You had constant kind of thunderstorms and weird atmospheric conditions. It was dark and it was cold. It was like sort of living permanently inside an old-fashioned horror movie. But worse than that, because the light and the heat of the sun was blocked, plants couldn't grow properly. And as the plants died, the animals that relied on those plants died as well. And as the plants and the animals died, people died. It led to the worst famine in northern Europe of the 19th century. It was absolute devastation. People, thousands upon thousands of people across northern Europe were starving to death. It must have been an absolutely awful time. Imagine these poor peasants out in the fields as their livestock is dying around them and the plants are turning brown and there's grey skies and thunderstorms the whole time. It must have felt like the end of the world, like some kind of new biblical apocalypse sent by God to kind of wipe mankind out. And strange things happened. In Rome, in the middle of summer, as all this stuff filtered down through the atmosphere, it snowed blood red snow. So it must have been absolutely terrifying. A really awful year. And a really, really awful year to book yourself a summer holiday in a villa on the shores of Lake Geneva. But that is exactly what a guy called Lord Byron did. Now, some of you may have heard about him. Some of you adults here may think, oh yes, I know who Lord Byron is, but you probably don't. You might pretend to your kids that you do. So I will tell you a little bit about Lord Byron. Lord Byron, as you can tell from his name, was an aristocrat. He was a very important member of British society. He was also a poet. Now, that might not mean much to you. These days, back then, being a poet was something important. This was in the days before rock stars and film stars. And the only way is Essex. Back then, you could be a famous poet. And poets were a big deal. And Byron was just about the most famous poet in Europe. He was very much like the rock star of his day. And he behaved very much like a rock star. He was very good looking. He had long, dark hair. He dressed often in black. He was kind of slightly moody. And he misbehaved quite badly in the way that rock stars are supposed to. He drank too much. He had affairs with people he wasn't supposed to have affairs with. If there had been the likes of Heat magazine around in those days, Lord Byron would have always been on the front cover. He was that kind of guy. He would have been photographed leaving a nightclub at 4 o'clock in the morning, drunk with someone he wasn't supposed to be with. And in fact, one of his girlfriends at the time came up with a description of him which would have made a perfect headline for one of these gossip pieces. She said that Lord Byron was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. That's the kind of guy he was. He upset the British establishment with his behaviour. And he, in turn, wasn't a big fan of the kind of snooty, stuffy British establishment. So he travelled a lot. In this particular year, he decided to stay in Switzerland. And he invited some other young friends to come stay with him, people who shared his attitudes, who were kind of anti-establishment in their way. Among them, he had taken his own personal doctor. In those days, if you were traveling, you would often take a companion with you. He took his own doctor with him. I suppose in much the same way that a rock star these days might travel with their own personal drug dealer. He had taken his own personal doctor to look after him, and he had a fantastic name. He sounded like something out of a kind of horror movie or an old sci-fi movie. He was called Dr. Polidori. So he was there, but Byron had also asked another up-and-coming young poet called Percy Shelley, who in his short life went on to become a very famous poet and is now one of our best-loved poets, the Romantic poets. But Shelley was like Byron. He lived an unconventional lifestyle. Although he was married to someone else, he had brought along with him his teenage girlfriend, Mary Godwin, with whom he had already had a child. So it was that kind of a gathering, up-and-coming, exciting young people with radical new ideas about the world. And it was a sort of slightly scandalous gathering. Again, if we'd had Heat magazine and they had been paparazzi with their long-lens cameras, the photographers would have hired boats and sat out on the lake trying to catch shots of the girls sunbathing topless on the beach or whatever. But of course, there were no paparazzi. And of course, there was no sunbathing because this was the year without a summer. It was cold and dark and wet and almost constant thunderstorms. So all the things that these young people had been planning on doing, boating, swimming, walking, horse riding, they couldn't do. They were stuck indoors in the rain. So what did they do? Well, they did what young people always do under these conditions. They wrapped themselves in blankets, they huddled around the fire, and they told each other scary stories, trying to freak each other out. They started by reading some of the books in the house. There were some collections of ghost stories there. Ghost stories have always been popular. But then somebody said, look, we're a bunch of clever young people. We've got some writers here. I'm sure we could do better than this. Why don't we see if we can come up with our own scary story? See who can come up with the best scary story. So they did. They went off to their rooms to try and think up some ideas. Shelley wrote a fairly conventional, old-fashioned ghost story. Byron was a little bit more imaginative. He wanted to do something a bit different. Now, as I said, he liked to travel a lot. And one of the areas that he was particularly interested in was part of Eastern Europe known as the Balkans, which is this mysterious, remote, cut-off, mountainous region north of Greece, with countries like Romania there. And travelling there, he became very interested in the kind of local customs and beliefs of the people. And he particularly was interested in the idea of this creature that the locals believed in called the Strigoi. Now, we today know a Strigoi as a vampire. And all our ideas about vampires and all our myths about vampires come from the Balkans. This is where the vampire stories originated, in the tales of the Strigoi. Now, these weren't fairy tales. These weren't folk myths. These weren't stories made up to frighten children. The people of the Balkans seriously believed that vampires were real, that the Strigoi really existed. What would happen would be you'd be in one of these remote villages. Somebody might fall ill and die, and they would bury them in the local graveyard. And then a few days later, someone else in the village might fall ill. They might die. And then someone else. Now, we today, we know how disease works, how contagion works, how you can pass germs from one person to another. But this is a fairly recent discovery in medicine. Back then, in the Balkans, people didn't understand how disease works. And often, when people don't understand how something works, they will invent supernatural causes. They would say it's God, or it's a demon, or in this case they would say it is the Strigoi. What they would believe was happening was that this person that they had buried, this dead peasant, had become a Strigoi, and at night it would awake in its coffin and it would claw its way out of the grave and go crawling into the town. Now, we're not talking here about the kind of sexy, modern, teenage, blow-dried Robert Pattinson sort of a vampire. We're talking about a dirty, dead, smelly peasant crawling out of the grave in tattered clothing, rotting flesh, and going crawling through the mud into town, where they would seek their victim, they would latch onto them, and they would drain their life force so that they could carry on living beyond the grave, and then they would return to the graveyard, leaving the person that they had fed off ill and dying. That's what they thought was happening. So they would get together. They would have a collection of the village elders, and they'd say, well, it's clear that Fred, or whatever his name is, must have become a Strigoi, so we'd better dig him up and look for any signs that he's not as dead as he should be. So they would go back to the graveyard, they would dig up this coffin, they would open it up, and they would look at Fred. Now, perhaps his hair might have grown a bit, or his fingernails might have grown a bit. Perhaps his flesh wasn't as rotten as it should be. Perhaps he didn't smell as much as they expected him to. All things that could happen after death anyway. So they would say, okay, it's clear Fred has become a vampire, and unless we stop him, he will keep returning from the grave until he has destroyed our entire village. So they would say, well, how do we stop him from coming out of the grave? Well, there were various methods that people would use. The first method, simplest method, is simply to rebury the body face down. That way, if Fred comes awake in the night and starts trying to dig his way out, he's just going to dig himself deeper and deeper into the ground, like a kind of a vampire mole. Strigoi are obviously not particularly clever. Perhaps you want to be even more sure. Well, you could cut the head off. That way, if the body gets up and starts walking around trying to get into town, we won't be able to see where it's going, and we'll just bump into trees. But the most effective and the most common method of stopping a vampire from getting out of the grave is to take a wooden stake and to drive it through the center of the body. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to go through the heart, as long as it goes through the main part of the body. Because what you are actually doing is nailing the vampire to the floor. Like an insect collector might pin a butterfly to a board. If you can hammer this stake in hard enough, Fred will not be able to get out of his grave. He'll wake up and he'll just go, and eventually he'll give up. So that is the origin of the idea of the stake through the heart. It was a method used by people in the Balkans to stop vampires coming out of the grave. So if any of you kids here are worried that any members of your family might have become vampires or strigoi, then all you need to do is sneak into their bedroom at night, flip them over in the bed, cut their head off, and nail them to the bed with a bit of wood. You won't be bothered anymore. So, as I say, but Byron was fascinated with these stories, and he wanted to write his own vampire story. He changed the idea of the vampire in his story. He was no longer a dirty, smelly, dead peasant. He made the vampire in his story an aristocrat like himself, who was traveling through Europe like himself. And in his story, it starts in a graveyard where the hero of his story, Lord so-and-so, I can't remember his name, he's been mortally wounded in a battle and he's dying, and he says to his companions, "Bury me tonight, but don't worry, I will return in the morning because I am a vampire." He only really wrote that first opening chapter. He never got far beyond that. Mary Godwin, Shelley's teenage girlfriend, was the most successful of the people in coming up with a story there because she had a nightmare. I can imagine in these times, these awful times of famine and thunder and darkness and coldness, people must have had awful nightmares. And Mary Godwin particularly had bad nightmares because the first child she had had with Shelley had died when it was a baby. She was haunted by nightmares where she would have dreams where the baby was still alive. She was obsessed with the idea of life and death. And in fact, in these times, the idea of life and death was something that the young people talked about a lot. Shelley and Byron would stay up late in the night discussing what does it mean to be alive. It was a question a lot of people were asking in those days. Because for centuries, the church had said, all you need to know about life is that God gives you life and God takes it away. That's all you need to know. It's something from God. But human beings have always been curious and scientists have always been curious. And a lot of people have been saying, well, actually, what is life? How does it work? How is it? What is this mysterious force that runs through us that means that we can get up and walk around, that we can move our arms and legs, that we can talk, that we can think? How does that work? What is that force? In fact, one of the things that people at the time were beginning to think was, is it anything to do with electricity? Electricity had only recently been discovered. And people were looking at all the things that electricity could do. And there was a very popular experiment called galvanizing, where what would happen would be a doctor would go to Newgate Prison after a murderer had been hanged, and they would take the dead body, and they would come and do a demonstration like this to a hall full of people. They would put this hanged body of the murderer out on a slab, and they would take two wires hooked up to electricity with an electrode on each end, and they would go in and they would plug one into the mouth at the top end, then they'd go down the bottom end and look for a suitable socket there to plug the other plug into. They'd shove it up there and then they'd throw a switch and this body would suddenly, maybe an arm would start to twitch like this, or the eyes might come open. In some cases the mouth would start to move as if this body was trying to talk from beyond the grave. People were absolutely fascinated by this and started to think, could you create life? Would it be possible for one of these scientists, one of these doctors, to actually bring a dead body back to life or to create life where there was none before? So these young people were having all these discussions. Mary was having these nightmares. And she had the particular nightmare where she was in a locked room and there was a thing on a slab. It wasn't so much a dead body as the image of a man, like a sort of, almost like a statue. But as she looked at it, it came alive and it got down off the slab and it started to walk towards her. And she woke up terrified. And all these ideas were swirling around in her head about life and death and what it means. And she started to tell her friends a story about a young medical student called Victor who thinks he can play God and create life. Victor creates this image of a man and partly through the use of electricity, manages to bring it to life. But she creates this unnatural thing, and because it's unnatural, people are frightened of it, and because they're frightened of it, they grow to hate it, and they shun it from society. And because this poor creature is treated this way by people, it wants to get revenge. It turns nasty, turns aggressive, and it particularly wants to destroy Victor and his family. Now, I'm sure some of you kids here are ahead of me. What do you think the full name of Victor in that story might have been? Frankenstein, exactly. She came up with the story of Frankenstein. And everyone else there said, Mary, this is a brilliant story. You must finish it. So she did, and it was published a couple of years later, by which time Shelley's wife had conveniently committed suicide. He was able to marry her, and she'd become Mary Shelley. And thus was published Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, which came out of these events of this extraordinary year. It was a big bestseller. And it went on to become even better known as a play. Now, this was obviously before we had horror films and that, but people have always liked being frightened and liked going to see scary plays. And this Frankenstein story was a perfect vehicle for a play, with this creature being brought to life and stomping around the stage and killing half of Victor's family, and then Victor, Frankenstein, and the monster locked in deadly combat at the end of the story. And it became a popular play that ran for, well, in fact, it was not exactly the same version of it, but a version of it was recently on at the National Theatre in London. Always been a very popular subject. But Frankenstein wasn't the only finished story to come out of that summer. Because if you think back, if you remember the character of Dr. Polidori, Byron's personal doctor, he said to Byron, I really like this idea, this vampire story you've written. Are you going to finish it? And Byron said, no, I've got to go away and write a very long poem. But if you want to finish it, be my guest. So Dr. Polidori did. He took the bare bones of the story that Byron had written, expanded it into a longer work. And he very much based the vampire in his story. It was published as The Vampire, and it was the first proper vampire story published in England. And he completely based the vampire in his book on Lord Byron. So Lord Byron, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, is the model of the aristocratic vampire that we know so well, with the kind of brooding good looks and that kind of whole aristocratic lording it over people manner. And in Dr. Polidori's story, the vampire is traveling through Europe with a companion, seducing a number of young women so that he can drain their life force and live off them and become immortal. In fact, it's probably that aspect of the story that was one of the things that had excited Byron, the idea of immortality, that you can feed off other people to become immortal. All writers worry about these things. Will we be remembered beyond our graves? Will we be an immortal writer? And we're all vampires in a way, draining your life force by getting you to read our books. Dr. Polidori's vampire story in turn became a big hit. It too was turned into a play, which became a very successful play. And one of the things that really made this play stand out was they came up with a new invention in the theatre that they hadn't had before. It was invented specifically for this play. This was a trapdoor that they built into the stage that was that could be opened very quickly, and there would be a spring-loaded platform underneath where the actor playing the vampire could wait and at certain moments could pop up out of nowhere. You'd have a puff of smoke on the stage, and suddenly the vampire would be there as if from nowhere. People had never seen this before and were shocked and delighted. And that type of trapdoor in a stage is still today called a vampire trap. And the most popular version of this play, they relocated the action to Scotland. And the vampire is known as Lord Ruthven, and he stomps about on his estate, frightening people in a kilt and a tam o'shanter hat. Now, that's not my image of a vampire. I think if Robert Pattinson had been forced to wear a kilt and a tam o'shanter in the Twilight movies, those films would not have been such a hit, and he would not have gone on to become the sexy superstar that he is today. But apparently people were very frightened by Lord Ruthven and his kilt. I only hope that when they threw him up out of his trapdoor, he didn't come up too fast and give the audience more of a shock than they were expecting. But there you go, that was the play. And we move forward now to 1870, to the Lyceum Theatre in London, where The Lion King is on today. And there was an Irishman working there as the theatre manager called Bram Stoker. He was familiar with the vampire play. And that book and that play had actually led to a kind of craze for vampire literature in the 19th century. There were innumerable stories and books and other plays based on the idea of the vampire. And he thought he would try and write the ultimate vampire story, would collect all the vampire myths and put them all in one book and write the vampire story to end all vampire stories. So he set about writing his book, and he hit on a fantastic name for his vampire, or so he thought. He was going to call his vampire Lord Vampire. And I think, you know, Lord Vampire wearing a kilt that would have killed off vampires forever. But somebody obviously said to him, they said, Bram, that's a really rubbish name for a vampire. You can do better than that. So he went back to his local library to carry on researching about vampires. And he looked into the whole history and the mythology of vampires and where they came from, the history of Romania, and he found out about this small kingdom, independent kingdom within Romania, which in the Middle Ages was its own little kingdom, called Transylvania. And he found out about a king, a ruler of Transylvania, called King Vlad. And King Vlad was an extraordinary man. He was an extremely powerful ruler, but he was also an extremely feared ruler. He ruled Transylvania with an iron fist. You're all sniggering a bit because he doesn't look much, does he, in that picture? But he was a terrible, terrible man. And he ruled Transylvania with an iron fist. If anybody in Transylvania did anything to upset him, didn't matter who they were, man, woman, child, old person, family pet, if he didn't like you, he would take you and all your family out into a field and have you impaled on wooden stakes. And there he is, look, there is Vlad, enjoying a picnic in a field while a number of his subjects are being impaled in front of him there, and just for good measure, he's having some of them chopped up as well. Not a very nice man, and it earned him the nickname Vlad the Impaler, which has got to be the best name ever for an evil tyrant. Beats Colonel Gaddafi hands down. Vlad the Impaler. And obviously Bram Stoker got fascinated by this character because you've got this ruler kind of feeding off his own people. You've got the idea of the stakes through the bodies, the obsession with blood and death. And he looked up to find out what Vlad's proper name was, because obviously he wasn't christened Vlad the Impaler. That came later. And he found out that Vlad's father, Vlad the Elder, who had ruled before him, had been a member of the Order of the Knights of the Dragon of Transylvania. The word for dragon in Transylvania was Dracul. So his father was known as Vlad Dracul, and as son of Dracul, Vlad the Impaler's proper name was Vlad Dracula. And Bram Stoker thought, that's actually a better name than vampire, isn't it? So he nicked it. And thus was born Dracula, the best known and probably the best of all the vampire stories ever written. So it's extraordinary to think that these two strands of literature and these two great books, Dracula and Frankenstein, both had their origins that summer in 1816. That extraordinary summer where these clever young people got together and started throwing ideas around. And for me, the Frankenstein story is the first zombie story. It's about a dead thing being brought back to life. And certainly in the play of it and in the film of it, it's much more clear that this is a corpse, that this is a dead thing out of the graveyard that Frankenstein has brought to life. And like all subsequent zombies, not very happy about being brought back to life and goes on the rampage murdering everybody. So vampires and zombies, for me, were born that summer. And they are now everywhere. We're suffering from this plague. See, the interesting thing is, what's happened in the last couple of years is it's become vampires for girls and zombies for boys. It's not an exact split, There are still many boys who like vampires and many girls who like zombies, but there has become this thing where we've got vampires for girls. Well, actually, let's do a quick show of hands. Stick your hands up if you're more of a vampire person. Yeah. What about zombies then? Yeah, as I say, it's not an exact split, but there does seem to be this thing. Girls, teenage girls, seem to have got it into their heads that they would like to go out with vampires. I don't know why this is. You have to say to them, you're not supposed to snog a vampire. You're supposed to stick a stake through their heart, cut their head off, maybe set fire to them for good measure. You're not supposed to date them. No, but girls think vampires are cool and sexy and sophisticated. And they hang out together in these moody bars after dark, having these like really intense conversations, because they're like hundreds of years old, so you can have a really great conversation with them, you know. So that's their ideal boyfriend, is a vampire. Nobody wants to go out with a zombie, do they? Zombies are dirty. They've got terrible dress sense. Their trousers hanging off their arses. They shuffle about the place, communicating in grunts. They're basically teenage boys, aren't they? Which is probably why boys like them so much. So unfortunately, girls, whilst you might like to go out with a vampire, you are going to end up going out with a zombie, I'm afraid. It's a fact of life. But boys particularly love zombies because you can splatter them all over the place. And they're very gory and nasty and disgusting. And for me, it all goes back to that summer. And as we hit the 20th century and they invent cinema, in the early days of cinema, what did they use as vehicles for their play? For their films, they would take popular plays and film them. Frankenstein was one of the first full-length films made back in 1911 by the Edison Company. They made an early feature-length version of Frankenstein. There he is, if you can see him. Probably the most scary-looking monster you've ever seen. But it frightened people at the time. The big leap in horror films was the invention of sound, of course, in the early 1930s, where Universal Pictures said, if we made a horror film with sound, that would really frighten people. You could hear the crash of the thunder, the scream of the terrified girl, the roar of the monster. You could use music to boost it. And the first two films they made were Dracula and Frankenstein, which led to a huge explosion of horror films in the 1930s, mainly made by Universal. These films were so successful, they went on to make Son of Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and then they thought, well, let's put the monsters together. So they had Frankenstein meets Dracula, and then they all made up their own monsters. The mummy, the werewolf was entirely invented by Universal. So they then had Frankenstein and Dracula meet the werewolf. Frankenstein and Dracula and the werewolf go on holiday together. They tried every variation of these things until people were sick of horror films and sick of these movies, and the Second World War came along where the world was plunged into real horror and the appetite for these films diminished. And it was only really with an English company called Hammer Films in the 1950s who they came up with the idea of what if we made a horror film in color? You could see the blood, the bright red blood squirting everywhere. And what did they do? They went back to Dracula and Frankenstein. And these films were huge hits. And it led to the kind of modern boom for horror films, which is still with us. For me, though, the greatest and scariest horror film of all time was made in 1969. It was actually made in black and white. It's unusual for the time. And it was called Night of the Living Dead. And it was the film where we first saw cannibal, flesh-eating zombies. There'd been zombie films before. They weren't that frightening and that gory. But George Romero, who wrote and directed this film, came up with the idea that dead bodies come back to life and all they want to do is eat you. I saw this film as a teenager and it absolutely terrified me. And it stuck with me ever since. For me, the zombie is always the scariest of the movie monsters. Because zombies are people. And often they can be people that you know. That's what really that gets to me with a good zombie movie, is that this thing that is trying to get into your bedroom and kill you and tear your guts out, it could be your best friend, your girlfriend, your boyfriend. It could be your mother, your father. It could be one of your children. But somebody that you knew and loved has died horribly, and now all they want to do is kill you and eat you. And I find that very, very disturbing and frightening and upsetting. So having written my James Bond books, having done thrillers for kids, I thought, let's try and do horror for kids. I've always loved horror. And I thought, if I could really scare a kid, if I could scar them for life, they would always remember my book. And as I say, I'm like Byron. I want immortality through being remembered through my books. So the zombie for me was the obvious place to go to for a story. And I've got three boys. They are absolutely obsessed with zombies. They play these zombie games the whole time. So it seemed the obvious thing to do. I wanted to do it a bit different, so I put it together with another idea, an idea I'd had since I was the age of you kids here, which is, wouldn't it be fantastic if all the adults in the world just simply disappeared? You could have the place to yourselves. You could go anywhere you like. You could do anything you like. Nobody to tell you when to get up in the morning, what to eat, what to wear, when to go to bed. You could stay up all night drinking Coca-Cola and watching DVDs and playing Xbox games. If you get bored of that, you might want to go shopping and get some new stuff, so you could take the bus into town. I don't mean stand at the bus stop in the rain. I mean take the bus, drive it yourself into town and smash into as many cars as you like along the way. There's no one to stop you, and then you can go window shopping. Drive straight through the front of the shop window and fill the bus with flat-screen TVs, DVDs, computer games, the works. I always thought it was a fantastic fantasy to have fun with all these great things that adults have that they never really enjoy properly. You know, I remember going to museums as a kid, like somewhere like the Imperial War Museum. All I wanted to do was get hold of those guns, wear those uniforms, put those spiked helmets on, and play with this stuff. But adults keep it all nicely locked away behind glass cabinets. So that was a fantasy I had, a world of kids. And I put it together with the zombie idea, and I came up with the idea that a disease has wiped out everyone over the age of 14. It's either killed them outright or turned them effectively into zombies. So kids are now trying to survive in their own world. They're trying to look after themselves, to rebuild the world, whilst trying to avoid being eaten by the adults.